given a couple of these talks. Very happy to be in St Kilda because, of course, Albert Jacko was the mayor of St Kilda for a short period. Now, the book, Albert, as already has been introduced by Maya, it's written as a novel, and I'm pleased to say that the last I heard from my sister in Canberra, some friends of hers have an 11-year-old son, and he read the book this Christmas, which I thought was a marvellous result that an 11-year-old who doesn't have to read a book actually reads a 370-page book in his Christmas holidays. I think it's a bit like Man Bites Dog, that one. And so I'm very pleased, and I know that the oldest reader that I know was 89, so there's quite a range of people who have read the book. And the reason why I wrote it, a lot of people ask me that question. I should really have a little card that I hand out on that one. But the reason I wrote it is that I was, well, I'll go back to my daughter. She won Australian History Prize, was given Reds Caroline Gallipoli as the prize. And I was, 2001, I was flying up to Papua New Guinea a lot that year for work. And I was on the plane a lot, so I needed something to read. I grabbed the Caroline, I'm reading through it, a magnificent book, and I'm reading through it, very emotional, and getting to page 281, and there it is, Albert Jacka, and what he did in, you know, just a couple of paragraphs. And I just thought, wait a minute, I've never heard of Albert Jacka. I've never heard of Albert Jacka until that moment on the plane halfway to Papua New Guinea. And I mean, I am a South Australian originally. There's some excuse there, but not totally. And I thought, no. And I thought that, yeah, maybe I'm, you know, just ignorant myself. But I did talk around with people of my generation, people younger and a bit older, and so on. And I found that, you know, 90 to 95% of people just didn't know who Albert Jacka was. You know? And I thought, well, this is a great pity because this was a, you know, this was an Australian, and he, I think. He lived those values that I think Australia is built on, and so I thought his name should not be forgotten, and I thought I must do something, and I thought because a history book had been already written in 1989, Jacka VC by Ian Grant, which was a historical work, and I read that and I thought, yeah, this is good, but I can't imagine an 11-year-old reading Jacka VC. It's just, you know, too much detail, you know, and it's just not written in a way that would be accessible to a young person like that. So I thought, what this needs is a novel style, and so I wrote it as a novel as a result of that. So can we go to the first slide, please? Okay, now this little road here, the Great Ocean Road. I showed this photograph recently to my CEO at work, and I said, what do you think that is? He recently bought a place up in Fairhaven. Mm-hmm. And the first thing he said was, the Great Ocean Road? And I said, no. It's something that should, this is where Australia was born. And it wasn't born on the Great Ocean Road. But can we have the next slide, please? Yeah. This is Anzac Cove, and this is Gallipoli. And so you can see that this is actually on the 19th of May, 1915, which is the day that Albert Jacka won his Victoria Cross. And you can see that all these valleys here, Shrapnel Valley and Monash Gully, Wanless Gully, that blue line is effectively the outer perimeter that the Anzac had. And beyond them were just many, many thousands of Turks. And those lines, those white lines, don't give you a real idea of how many trenches there were. If we just blocked that all out with white, if we wrote in all the trenches that the Turks had behind there, the massive impediment that they had in front of them. Up here is Lone Pine, which was an enormous fight just to win that little stretch of land. And the actual battle that Albert Jacka fought on that 19th of May, because the Turks, General Saunders, who was leading them, decided that they'd make one big push. 45,000 men were massed just behind Queen's Post, Courtney's Post, and Steele's Post, which is just over here, to push them over this ridge. And Courtney's Post, just up there, is where Albert Packer was at that time. And they ended up shooting down and killing about 7,000 or 8,000 Turks that night, and wounding many thousand more who straggled back to their own trenches. But 12 Turks got into this section of trench where Albert Jacker was. See that technical slide. This is a closer shot of, this is Longless Gully, and that's Myesh Gully up there. This line up here, and that spot there is really Courtney's Post, and that's Queen's Post just up there. So it was just on this stretch of land here, probably just where this bend in the road is here, where the Turks got through and into that trench, and where Albert Jacker basically single-handedly jumped into a trench full of 12 Turks on his own, and came out of the other end without a scratch on him, with 7 Turks dead in the trench, 2 trying to get out, got shot by one of his mates, and 3 who just put their hands up because Jacker was coming for them. And so that is why he won the Victoria Cross at Corn's Coast, and Myers was delighted because he was in his brigade. That was the first Australian VC to be won in the Great War, although there were about half a dozen VCs won in South Africa in the South African War prior to that. Can we have the next slide? So, deliberately, the birth of a legend. What I'm going through now is a section of the book. The first section of the book is called Deliberately, Birth of a Legend. And the next slide, please. Okay, so there's Lance Corporal Albert Jacker on the left. Not a big bloke. In fact, I think it was a disadvantage to be big. You're a bigger target. When the war started out, I think he was about 5'6", and I think he came back from the war about 5'8", something like that. But he was, in those days, that was sort of average height. There were people that were shorter than that and taller than that. And the 3 guys on the right-hand side were Lance Corporal Bill Howard on the left there, Lance Corporal Steve Baruch in the middle, and Brett Thomas on the right-hand side. Now, that photo there was given to me by Aileen and Mari Howard, who were the daughters of Bill Howard, and they live in Bendigo now. Lovely ladies. So they gave me that photograph. Now that's their father. He had a wonderful tenor voice. When he was in the POW camp, his cannons were taken back to the opera. But he sang in the Catholic Cathedral in Bendigo, in the choir. And Steve Baruch, just to say a bit about him, his father's name was Manuel de Aragon, who was a Portuguese migrant to Australia. Steve grew up in Bendigo with these guys, handling the water. Do you have any slides? Here's some more on Steve, because Steve, his son, gave me that photo on the right and on the left. Both of those photos were given to me by Steve's son, who is Vin Baruch, who lives in Bendigo today. And he has 2 sons, Chris and Paul, it's a great story, but lovely people, the Baruches. And I think when I was up in Bendigo for Remembrance Day last year, I had photographs of about 15 Baruches around me. So they were very, very good mates. Now those are the 3 guys that backed him up backed Jacker up in the trenches, and he was always happy for that. Steve came back as a lieutenant, and Vin gives a very heartrending story about the Great Depression, when Steve was out of work and used to have to trudge in 1931 down the railway yards for 4 or 5K and finally out with no work, and trudge back at home again and had nothing to show to the family. A guy that had come back from the war with a scar on his back that Vin reckons he put your hand into. So that's Steve. Now, I told you about the Vin and then Paul and Chris. Now, Paul had a daughter, next slide, That's her there, Kate Burrush. She won Australian Idol in 2005. You probably saw her on the TV. So if things had gone a bit differently at Courtney's post, and the Turks had just pushed through a bit more, Steve would have been dead and there'd been someone else that would have been winning Australian Idol in 2005, that's for sure. So next. So here are just some more characters that I can call them in my novel, but they're real people. They're all, everyone in the novel is a real person. And that existed. But actually, yeah, that's the St. Kilda foreshore at the bottom there, and Padre Andrew Gillison of the East St. Kilda, now Uniting Church, the Presbyterian. Who was consecrating the 14th Italian colours that now stand in the town hall. And that's him on the right there. In the middle is Lieutenant Colonel Charles Gare, who was a captain and a major at Gallipoli, but later was promoted to Lieutenant Colonel in Egypt. Baby face, 26 years old, 1,000 souls, he's 26. You've got 1,000 souls that you command life and death over. With quite a number of them being older than him, and unfortunately didn't quite get it with them. And the other thing is that he came from, let's say, the right side of the tracks, which Jacket came from the left side, and he was the one that's credited with standing in the way of Jack's promotion to officer. And on the left is Captain Alfred Lochie Williamson. Lochies were different in those days. Today he'd be called Averagey. but as Ted Rule in Jack's mob says, Lochie Williamson, like an Adonis, 6 foot in his socks. And 6 foot in his socks was a big bloke in those days. But Harold Lochie Williamson, and he was an Australian rules football player. He was a teacher of manual craft at Melbourne High School, and also was an Australian rules football player. Played for Carlton and got elbowing. I think he got docked 3 games or something for elbowing in 2014 or 2013 season. Anyway, so that's some of the other people that are involved in the Gallipoli. One more slide, please. Okay, well, now this is you see that early shot that I showed you was the early part of the campaign, 19th of May. We showed you, and basically there's Courtney's post and Queen's post that we're talking about, and the neck is where that Peter Weir film Gallipoli. That last charge happens. That happens just over here at the neck. The charging across that stretch of land there. But basically, they had this was all they controlled at that time. But in early August, the British wanted to flank the Turks. So Suvla Bay, which you can't see, is just off the chart over here. They landed a big force up at Suvla Bay, and the Australians were swinging around this way to try to flank the Turks. And in place up here is noted Hill 60, which apart from the neck and Crickier down south, this Hill 60 is probably one of the worst sort of massacres of Australians that happened at Gallipoli. Here, one more slide. Now this is the scene that you had at Hill 60, and I present this in the novel. You've got the 13th and 14th battalions over here ready to charge across there, the New Zealanders further down here, Brits and Indians. You've got the whole empire at work here. I'm sure this looked good on somebody's map when they were sort of drawing these lines initially and planning this thing. But this is actually a river course down here. You can't see the land, but it goes down here and comes up there, and you've got a 7 to 10 foot lift in front of you like that. Right, you come up to it, you'd be coming up to something like this wall here. That's what they were running across. But of course, there was machine guns all along here, and machine guns firing from here as well, from the Turks. This is 200 yards, and the first wave that went across, out of 150 men, 40 made it to the other side. The second wave came up, the same thing happened, about 40 made it. And the third wave basically didn't get there until after dark, because they got shot to pieces as well. And the 10 pound shields of the British came through. Just as they started to charge, a big shell, one they called the Jack Johnson, because he was the great black fighter of the day, came in and just obliterated them. And only one Hampshire made it to the other side. And so this was the Battlefield 60, and that is depicted in the book. I won't tell you too much about it. I want to keep some surprises going. But Captain Loughran, who was the medical officer, and he was in the trenches on this side, I went to the Australian War Memorial about 15 times when I was doing research for this book, and took out his letters that he was writing to Newton Wallace, who was the historian of the 14th Battalion. And it's just so wonderful that, you know, Newton Wallace existed, because if he hadn't, this wouldn't have been possible, because all that correspondence between Newton and the men of the 14th in the 1920s is what I based my book on. And because you've got their thoughts in there, you know what they're thinking. So I try to infuse all of that into the book. So although the book is not, you know, history as such, and I say that that it's not a biography or anything like that, it is a novel, but it is very informed by history. And so the next night they dug across a communication trench, and you see that there's this little path. That little path, based on a communication trench, is still there today. If you go and see it, this is a satellite photo. That's been taken recently. By the way, the other story I'll tell you is about these charts. I've been working on these charts and been putting them on we're putting them on that website, hardjacker.com, and the drawing and the taking of the picture and all of that has been done by a young guy called Jason Lamarchia, who's 26. He is up in Brisbane, and he is Albert Jacker's great grand nephew. Only he's about 6'4". So he's quite tall timber. And so he's been helping in drawing up these maps, and he gets really excited about stuff like that. That's Hill 60, so we can keep going. And so Egypt, they Gallipoli finishes, and then they come over to Egypt, and we have what I call the desert interlude. These are just some postcard shots of the day of Cairo, the sort of general Islamic look, if you like, there on the top, but the European look down here, because Egypt at the time, about a quarter of the population of Cairo, rather, a quarter of the population of Cairo was European at this time. Lots of, you know, imperialism was rife in those days. English and French and Germans all over these places. So this hotel here, and just around the corner there, that tree probably is over in the Uzbekia Gardens, which is just on the other side of Abramil Pasha Boulevard then. Around the corner is the front of the Shepherd's Hotel, which was a, you know, favourite watering hole of the officer class of the British Army. And part of the book takes place in that hotel. Next slide, please. And here we have what I'll call the subplot of the book. Captain Harold Wanless, DSO. He is from the other side of the tracks, again from Wanless, Jacka. Tall, dark and handsome, and ducks of Ballarat College, and ducks of Hawkesbury Agricultural College, and captain of every football team and cricket team, and a great guy, you know, it was hard to find something bad on this guy. You know, you have to throw in something. But he is just, seems just as his cousin. His first cousin is still alive, Tom Wyndham. Lived out of Bradford, not far from me, actually. And I found myself, like a couple of weeks ago, going up to Kim, my wife and I were going up to Kim Jagger's place, up in Launching Place, for a barbecue, and we're driving past Wanlitz's place, and I just said to my wife, well, this is eerie, you know. I mean, here we are, 90 years down the track from these events, and we're driving past the cousin of one of them, and we're going to the nephew of the other, of these people that were depicted. So, Harold Wanlitz is, the duckbot of the book, and it's all an interesting story. That is his sister Marion Wanlitz, who was a great conservationist later in life, and I think she was born that way, really. A remarkable woman too. I mean, just to take up medicine in those days for a woman was a bold stroke, and. She had plenty to get up and go. In fact, the other night I was at a function. You just get these people, you know, the connections come through everywhere. And I found out, for example, that Geoffrey Blaney's wife, Anne, Marion was her mentor. The other night I was sitting with a lady from Erie's Inlet at a function, and she said, that, you know, Marion just inspired her in her youth and so on. So, yeah, next slide, please. So, Marion on the left has, you know, a sort of 14 or 15 year old had, she's much less animated in that photograph. They used to have a sort of a pose that you used to strike in those days, the photograph, didn't they? Certainly, her earlier, that photograph of her at 80, something years of age. She died in 1984, by the way. Leslie Moira Henderson and Joan Beckett Lindsay, who wrote Picnic at Hanging Rock. She's on the right. And Mount Macedon and all that, the scene is just like, they're so close to Picnic at Hanging Rock, you know? I mean, it's just all in the neighbourhood. You can see why it all happened. So we go through the next one. And so they're off to the Western Front, off to the Butcher's Picnic, as it was known. And here's another one of the characters that then gets introduced really on the boat as they're going across the Mediterranean from Egypt through to Marseille. Fred Anderson. Now I'll just tell you a quick story about how this happened, because there's been so many little coincidences that happened during the writing of this book. That are quite remarkable, and I was at a function commemorating the 60th anniversary of the D-Day landing, so it was on the 6th of June 2004, and sitting at a table with a couple of people around the table, and we were just reflecting on that issue that I raised before, that if one of our ancestors had copped an arrow or a bullet, you know, just a bit over from where they did cop that arrow or bullet, we wouldn't be sitting here tonight. Or it would be just an empty space. And suddenly this guy across the table from me said, well, I certainly wouldn't have been here because my grandfather was in the 14th battalion. And immediately I said, oh, so what's your name? And he said, Stuart Anderson. And I said, oh, so you are Fred Anderson's great-grandson. And he said, oh, how did you know that? He said, well, I know quite a bit about your grandfather because I've been writing this book. Oh. And then, about a week later, he turns up in the foyer at my work, and he's got a little package, and he goes, this is my grandfather's memoirs. You might like to have a read. And so I did the next few days on the tram, I'm just on this all the time. You know, I was supposed to get off at exhibition, and I think I finally got off at Swanson or something like that, because you're so mesmerized by this thing. And so I got a lot of it's just the picture, you know, I had the issue, but he just filled it in. His experience just filled it in. It was just a marvellous, you can see how, you know, on the previous slide, how, you know, the guy was built, you know, He was a 440 runner, 220s runner, you know, champion, Australian football player, you know, just an all-round sportsman, and the arms on him. At 17, he won the open, you know, long shot competition in the Western District there, and it's not as if that competition was so far off the world plate that, you know, these were just sort of provincials. No, his brother had a world record in long shopping. So yeah, he's talking about, you know, right at the cusp of things. Anyway, this is where he won the military medal at this spot in France, which is the first place they came to, and where Harold Wallace won his DSO on that field there. And that stream is the stream that they had to cross on that day, and the Australians were in there. They couldn't have trenches here because it's all low-lying soil. If you just dug a hole, it immediately filled with water, so you had to build up these parapets, so they built up dirt and sticks and everything they put together to hold these things up. So this raid that takes place, which is like the culmination of the first half of the book, really takes place on this field. Let's go to the next one, please. And then they didn't, the Armentier and Guadrenier, at that place where they were just now, they go down to the south to the centre of the Somme, by the Somme River, at Poggier. Next one, please. And this is the field. If you ever go there, you know, Albert is up that way, and well, the way I came down, I drove down here, and as soon as I saw the windmill monument on the right, I just stopped and got out there and took a few photographs. One of the photographs is in the book. And looked out into that field, and because I had a pretty good bearing on it, I just looked out and thought, yep, where that little white house is over there, 300 yards from here, that's where Jacka's famous charge at the Poggier Ridge, at the Battle of Poggier Ridge, took place. And you look at that windmill, and that house is just over here, and so you draw a line between it, basically right there, on the edge of this cornfield that takes place there. In fact, recently, because I've got the website, the guy whose, you know, grandfather was in the 14th had sent me a photo of him standing right on the edge of that cornfield. Where Jacka led that charge. And in this section here, Australians in 1 kilometre square around this area, sustained 23,000 casualties. More casualties than in any other place on Earth. It's a sort of mile square, 23,000 casualties. Next slide. And again, that's where it is there. That's the windmill. It used to be a German blockhouse that was built inside a windmill during World War One, and that house is just over there on the left. So it's looking out towards that house that line was. Okay, can we end this one? Yeah, so Bullecourt now. Bullecourt was the 4th Brigade's downfall because it was so ill-planned and hastily put together by British General Gough, who was really responsible for it. And I put the magnificence that this is not war. That was a comment that was made by a French soldier who witnessed the charge of the Light Brigade at Balaclava. Magnificent but not war. Because it's not war, it's slaughter. Next slide. So, we have to go up one. Yes, hit the top button. Oh, yeah, now the bottom button. Yeah, that's it. Brigadier General Charles Grant. So, at the start of the book, Colonel Deere is like Jacka's nemesis, and later in the book, General Grant becomes his nemesis. And he was an ex-school teacher from Queensland and former English migrants to Australia. And, we'll have to go back again. So that was the brand. I won't go into too much into it, people can read the book, but he was quite a character, tough character as well. Jagger was a tough character, and put two of those together, you have a real clash. And that's exactly what happened. And clashes, the kind that have probably never been seen. And the only reason that Jack had to clash with the general was that he was the most famous VC in Australia. And someone else had tried it, I'm sure they would have been clapped in irons and taken flat. But the other padre that came to the 40th Battalion, and Gillison was really revered as Gallipoli by the 40th Battalion, but Padre Francis Rowland was equally revered on the Western Front, and marvellous man. He later became the headmaster of Geelong College down in Geelong, really rebuilt that school and would make a knighthood for that Sir Francis Rowland he became. And I've got a letter from one retired accountant from Geelong who'd read my book, and he wrote me a lovely letter, and I mean a real letter, not an email, a letter. And he just said, and you might be interested to know that for the first 11 years of my schooling, he was my headmaster down at Geelong College, and I used to refer to him as St. Francis, not Sir Francis. But he was a remarkable person, a truly remarkable person. He's, next one, please. And these, that's it. Okay. These are the four colonels of the 4th Brigade. Brockman, Durant, and Charry Pitt. You can see that the guy on the right looks a different to the other three. I mean, he's got a different look about him. He is. He was the 14th Battalion's commander, and came up the hard way and was a coal miner, and went into the army. Hit Sydney with his role, and when it's gone, he joins up because he's not got nothing else to do. Then topped the NCO exams, and then works his way up and gets the colonel. Great character. This guy was a character, and he charmed the men of the 14th and rebuilt it. He was a professional soldier. But not only that, he was about the only officer that Jack, a senior officer that Jack ever came to a real meeting of minds with. He and Jack had got on just fine. Because he knew how to handle Jack. And so we'll probably go on to the next slide then. Okay, here's the plan at Bullet Corps and what it looked like. I put this is already on the website. Some of these other ones are going on the website next week, but this one's on the website. But it's in order to help people too that want to go there and see where it all was, because some of the things are a bit confusing. But this is basically where the main trench lines and where the Australians were, because there was this embankment, a railway embankment that just runs along here. That embankment is still there. And I remember driving my car in on this road, and I just drove up. I think I actually drove up to this spot here. That's right, because I drove up here, there's a little lane here, and just drove up here, got to about there, and I got there and I took this photo over the field out there. And it was just about where this tank ended up breaking down, right on top of the 48th Battalion headquarters. The 14th and 16th Brigade headquarters were here, and the 13th was there, 15th there. And effectively, the 4th Brigade had 3,000 men lined up out here on that day. By midday, that was at 4:30 in the morning, by midday, 2,399 of them did not come back. You can see that what they were charging into here, machine guns to the right of them, machine guns to the left of them, and machine guns in the front of them. A bit like the White Brigade. And miraculously, they took those trenches. and held them.
Let the crowd sit out.
Now this is that spot that I was just telling you about. This is part of that embankment, that railway embankment that is still there. And this spot, you can see how the land just disappears in here. There's a bit of a gap. That was the gap between the 4th Brigade and the 12th Brigade. The Württembergers, the Germans who held out for those 6-7 hours, surrounded by Australians on both sides, they put up a fight. In fact, the Australians who got, and this just tells you something about the character of those guys. When they were captured, the ones that were captured back there, the Germans took them back. The first thing they said to them was, "Bring them. You guys fought so well, you Württembergers. You take your hats off to you." The Germans in their reports, and this is in Charles Dean's history of the First World War, the Germans wrote these reports and they couldn't understand these people. When the Australians first got to the front, you know, they thought, how dare we the sons of the sons of Germany have to fight these ex-convicts. It was seen as an insult, but later it was seen as an honour. And in the end, they were seen in fear, because the Germans, and actually Monash wrote this to his wife, Victoria, and goes, "Victoria, you don't have to fear, because the Germans will not be pushing through on our sector of the front, because they fear us." And I've actually got this from debriefing the German officer myself personally, because he spoke perfect German. Anyway, so that's a bit about that battle, and there's Mr. Jean Lepal, who's the owner of the museum, private museum at Bull Corps, and he's holding the barrel of one of those tanks, the British tanks, that were supposed to be supporting the Australians at Bull Corps, and that's what's left of one of those tanks. And this little honeycomb down here, that's where they held the 6-pound shells that they were pulling out and putting into the barrel. That's anyway, so that's the bullet. If you go to Bull Corps, you've got to go to the Bull Corps Museum. Next slide, please. So then after that, they had to rebuild the 4th Brigade, and the 14th and 13th and 15th and 16th Battalions all had to be rebuilt again. They had to get in more reinforcements from Australia again and build it up. So we have the slide again. So there is a bit of a respite period here, and I have the Harold Wanless, who's the subplot. He goes off to Scotland on a parade. And he stayed in that hotel up on the top left-hand corner, which used to be called the Station Hotel when he stayed there, but is now called the West Highland Hotel. And so that's the scene in the foyer of the hotel, and just some shots of Malay, which is an old fishing port. Go out on the herring boats to fish. And this is also what happened. I mean, I didn't make this up. I discovered it. I'm like historians do. I just put some words around it, but this visit is in Harold's diary, and that diary is in his Australian War Memorial. And in fact, I have a 30-page appendix at the end of my book. So I have the novel, which goes to 370 pages, and then there's a 30-page appendix which has each section of the novel and says, well, here's what it's all based on. So you can make up your mind how much of this you think is real. I think that 95% of it is real, really. I mean, it is very close to reality. Well, you don't know what they all said everywhere, but I'm inventing dialogue in a lot of places that is consistent with what happened. But there is some quote-unquote real dialogue in there as well, which I acknowledge in my historical appendix, which is taken from sources that recalled it. And when I say real, I mean it's what they recalled maybe 5, 10, or even 15 years after the fact. So it may not be exactly what was said, but it's got the tone of what was said or what someone thought was said anyway. That's Malay. And then we've got, next one down, please. Yeah, and this is swinging the lead at the Royal Stables. And this picture was, I've never seen this picture before, it seems, because once I got everything going, you end up attracting like a magnet from these things. And it was the man on the left there, Captain Clark, right at the extreme left, he had this photograph and sent it as a postcard to his mother. And it's got a whole message to his mother on the left. He's very proud that, you know, I'm the Jack of BC, he's the guy that's just standing just over from me, etc. And that was sent over in 1917. And it was when Jacka was sniped in the leg. He was with a couple of other people, and one was killed, and he got a bullet through the leg, and went back to England to recuperate for a couple of weeks. And so he was taken, I think, Lady Halloway there, with this charming smile, looking at us. And you can see the Australian officer just next to Lady Halliwell, who's got an arm missing. His left arm is missing. It's just got tucked into his coat pocket. So swinging the leg is, you know, that expression they used to use, you know, for doing nothing, basically. Because at the end of the boat, they used to swing the leg, right, and throw it into the water to find out how deep the water was, right? But if you're just swinging and not throwing, then you're swinging the leg, which means you're not doing anything. But that's how Jackie used to describe what he was doing in England, swinging the leg. Next slide, please. And here is a picture. This is the place sort of further south on the... When I went over, I based myself in Lille, up in northern France and near Belgium, and drove down towards Paris. And the closest point to Paris is Ribemont, which is where the 14th Battalion used to, it was not in the line, it used to rest in that place, because it was far enough away from the battle that the bombs didn't get to there. And so part of the action also takes place in the book, in Ribemont. And this picture on the top left there is one that I remember from Harold, from Newton Wallace. Newton Wallace was Harold's father. He wrote the history of the battalion afterwards. Newton's history of the 14th Battalion had that picture in it. That was when the traffic used to be a lot thinner in Ribemont than it is today. I didn't feel like standing in the middle of the road and taking a photo, but I took it on the side. But I was driving along that village and I was thinking, I must see if that building that was in Newton Wallace's book is here somewhere. And I'm driving along and bang, right in front of you, that's where it is. Mm-hmm. And so I had to take that photograph to show that that's the spot that it took place. Mm-hmm. Oh, right, polygon wood is just thinking, is it? But polygon wood is where it really the whole book comes to a conclusion at polygon wood. And like I said, it's not a biography of Alma Jacka, it's Jacka in the war. And at Polygon Wood, Jacka reaches his zenith as a commander and in the field. So we go to the next slide, please. And this is a picture of Polygon Wood, and it's on the back, the village on the left there. And the actual wooded part of the wood and Polygon Wood, so presumably five sides for the wood, but it comes together in this point just up here, and there's this road that goes down there. There's a monument to the 5th Division just here, and in front of it there is a cemetery with all these white gravestones laid out in the cemetery. The 5th Division, which was Pompey Elliott's division, and you might have heard of Pompey Elliott, the famous Brigadier General who probably the greatest fighting brigadier general that Australia ever had. What a character he was as well. I call him actually Jacka with a law degree. That's what he was. He also talked back to the superior officers, and as a result he didn't get promoted, just like Jacka didn't. So Jacka should have been probably a major if not a colonel. Pompey Elliott should have been a major general but never got there because he couldn't keep his mouth shut. So they had these two objectives, the red line and the blue line, and the 15th Battalion came through here, the 4th Division, the 14th, before 16th came up to here, up to the red line, the 14th carried on. This is sort of a leapfrogging tactic that they used to have. And so Jacka was in charge of D Company over here, and Wanless was in charge of A Company on this side. And so I then, from this spot, just took a photo down to the wood there, as you just, the next, that spot there, that's what the wood looks like at that point. And I must say, I've got my car parked just behind me, and I'm so excited that I met Polygon Wood, you know. And French car, hire car, so I sort of got back into the car, and I tried to start at my car. I've been starting it all day, what's going on? And then I waved down someone who was driving down this road, and a sort of a Belgian farmer in his S-Class Mercedes. And he couldn't speak English, but, you know, I sort of made arm movements the same stuff, you know. And he went off, and then this little van, a little white van came in, and these male and female in the van, and they said, in English, and they said, "Do you want some help?" And I said, yeah, but this gentleman in the Mercedes just took off to get help. And they said, "Where is he?" Anyway, so actually that felt very, all you had to do was know French, I mean, my example. Because he goes, what are you doing? I've got in the car, and he said, "Do what you're doing." I did, and it's not working. And then there's a voice that comes up and said, "You have to have your foot on the brake while you're actually putting the ignition on." It's simple. It's simple, but you know, when you're excited, you lose track of these things. If we go to the next slide, please. So the epilogue now. So it really comes to the end of the story at Polygon Wood, but there's the epilogue, which is effectively how what happened to them, a lot of the people, what happened to those people. So if back. Yeah, okay, well here's Captain Ted Rule on the left, and Muriel Tuck, that he married. He was the author of Jacket Mob, which came out in 1933, just after Albert Jacket died, at the age of 39. Unfortunately, and so he's a lovely character, and his it all comes out in his Jacket Mob. The only problem with Jacket Mob that I saw was, and I loved the book, but it sort of jumps all over the place, and it's got all these stories, but it's not a story. And I thought, an 11-year-old, I'm not going to read that. And so that's why I thought they had to put it into a context that will be read today by the youth of today. And that's Captain Fred Anderson, the wood chopper, on the right. So this is another one, Margaret Hayton from England, who he married and brought back to Horsham. Huh? Gee, that was a contrast, I'll bet. There always is that analogue in England, isn't there? So you see, imagine today that suddenly 250,000 young men of the ages of 18 to 25 die, just disappear. And what impact that's going to have on the 18 to 25-year-old women of Australia today. And then a whole bunch of others actually marry people from outside, so they come back, and they're out of action, and so there's just this, it's like a spinster machine that's been created. And so many people remember their aunts who didn't marry because they weren't the boys before. Okay, so if we continue then, and another happy wedding that took place, and this is interesting because this fellow here, that's Albert Jacka, the best man, at his brother's wedding, Bill Jacka, and that's Bill over there, but the contrast in the photo is very bad, and Joan Jacka, who is all that white with a couple of eyes, just a couple of eyes there. It's more of like a negative of a person here, actually. But she The way it happened is that Albert won Victoria Cross, but he's in hospital in London, and people in Capwell in Wales read about it in the paper, and so they write to him and say, "What, are we related? Because we're Jackers too." So he came down to check it out, and no, we're not related. And then he went back, and he got his brother and brought him back after the war. The next thing you know, his brother's getting married to Joan. And the other coincidence is that Joan's mother, who's over there in the middle there, just behind the vicar, that's Elizabeth Jacker, who is Joan's mother. And Bill's mother is also Elizabeth Jacker.
Oh,
that's right. So they had this whole set of coincidences happening. Anyway, next slide. And this is back in Australia. And that's Lance Corporal William Howard, by the way. Another photo of him took in by Aileen Murray, the tenor. He got captured at Bullsport, by the way. He was lucky. He got across that field of death and was captured alive and sent to POW camp and got through the war and ended up coming back home. And actually, this is again to say, this is that's Bill Howard just there. He's got his eyes closed, but that's Bill there and Albert Jacker there. And this is back in Melbourne. Then they were back after the war. Had a number of public meetings, and you see some people. Well, you see this fellow here. He's got half his face missing. Great scars. Anyway, so next slide. And here we have another group. This is much more recent. This is in August last year at the launch of my book in Collins Street. And this is who I was talking about earlier. That's Jason LaMarchia there. And this is Chris DeRouche. It's Steve DeRouche's grandson. He was there. Ken.
Yeah.
Ken Jacker here. Tom Wanlitz, who is the first cousin of Harold Wanlitz, and his son. And his son, Peter. So Peter and he are both cousins of that Harold, that was the second cousin and first cousin. And so on, and then there's Bill Jacker as well, who's grandson of Bill Jacker, who was Albert Jacker's brother. And Ken was the son of Sidney Jacker, who was Albert Jacker's brother. And so on. So that's a group of descendants and relatives of the 40th Battalion who came to the launch, and it was great to have them there as well. But we keep going. One more. Oh, and Harold Wanlitz of Hazelnut Orchard. Now, Harold wanted to go into politics, but he had a farm up in the, just above Lawn. You ever gone up to Euston Falls?
Yeah.
You drive up the road and come to the top of the road, of the bitumen road, and then you start to descend down to the Euston Falls. Just off the left is a little dirt road. So you go up on that dirt road just for 200 yards, on the right-hand side of the road, is this orchard. That was planted by Harold Wanlitz back in 1913. And it's still there today. And it's the next slide, it's still bearing fruit. And so I think that the whole legend still bears fruit. The legend of Albert Jacker, the first AIS. Thank you.